Hey, everybody, the Other People podcast is offered freely. All episodes of this program, more than 600 episodes and counting, are all available for free. It's entirely free. If you like the show and you want to throw a few bucks in the hat, you can do that at patreon.com/otherpplpod. That's patreon.com/otherpplpod. Okay? Thank you. Hey, everybody. How's it going? Welcome to the Other People podcast. I'm Brad Listy. I'm in Los Angeles. It's good to be with you. I have Adam Popescu on the program today. He is a longtime journalist who has written for publications like the New York Times, Washington Post, Vanity Fair. He's done work for the BBC, just to name a few. And he has a debut novel out called Nima. It's available from Unnamed Press. So my conversation with Adam Popescu is coming up. I don't have much to talk about here. We're now into October. September was by far the biggest month in the show's history, so thanks to you guys again for listening. I forget what, I think it was 100, the audience in September was 100% bigger than the audience in August, which is unusually high growth. And it's the fourth consecutive month that the show has broken its 30-day listenership record. So huge thanks for, you know, for listening and spreading the word. I can't say it enough. Otherwise, one thing I did want to share with you, I don't normally talk too much about my day job stuff, but I am working for a company called Knowable, which is a venture-backed platform that just launched this past week. You might have seen it in the news if you follow that sort of thing. It was in TechCrunch and Yahoo Finance and so on and so forth. But it's an audio education company. You know, we make audio education. I'm a producer for them. I produced a class called How to Sleep Better, which is an in-depth exploration of sleep. How to do it better, what it is, why we do it, how it works. Dreaming, lucid dreaming, all of it. I interviewed experts from Oxford University, Stanford, like leading sleep doctors, people who work with like the Navy SEALs and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So it's a really interesting project that I worked on, and listeners of this program can get 20% off. It's like a 4.5-hour course, plus you get, there's 14 hours of extended interviews, I think, or 13 hours of extended interviews. There's guided meditation, sleep music, some bedtime stories from Ben Laurie. For those of you who know Ben's work, he's been a guest on this show. He's a buddy of mine. And it's $100. So you get 20% off if you use the offer code OTHERPPL. If you want to do that, just go to knowable.fyi and check it out. The course is called How to Sleep Better. And like I said, listeners of this show get a deal. It would be great if you're interested in sleep or if you have problems with sleep. It's worth it. It's pretty cool. So there's my plug, and let's get on to the program. My guest again is Adam Popescu, journalist and author of the debut novel Nima, available from Unnamed Press. It was great to meet him and talk with him. He's been he's an adventurer. He's been all over the world doing interesting things, chasing down snow leopards. Like, we get into it. So here he is, folks. This is Adam Popescu, and his novel, one more time, is called Nima.
I feel like I've suffered plenty. I don't know if that's really helped me. I don't think that you should have to break apart financial gain and happiness with art, you know? I think sometimes there is these romantic notions. Listen, you have a house, you have kids, you should want to make these things grow and develop and whatnot. And I think that the natural way to do that, I think, is cashing in and give me a large percentage for giving these ideas.
Well, yeah, you could be my manager. Need somebody.
I wouldn't go that far.
Well, let's talk about you. Let's talk about Nima. This feels to me like a bit unexpected for a guy with your profile to write a book about a Sherpa, a young Sherpa girl,
sure,
in the Himalayas, written from her perspective, her point of view. Like, that creative choice, I have to imagine you weighed the risk in terms of, like, what the response would be. I can imagine there could be a voice in your head thinking, like, you know, what right do I have? And do people really want, you know, some guy from the West to be taking this on? And do I have any authority to do such a thing? And so on and so forth. So for listeners who are coming in cold, why don't you just give, like, a brief overview of the novel, and then also talk about the experiences and the decision-making process that you went through that led to you writing it.
So the novel Nima is a work of fiction that takes place on Mount Everest. I was in Nepal, and I went to Everest in 2013 for the BBC. I went to base camp, which is 18,000 feet and takes about 2 weeks. And you have to walk through glacier and ice. I went in December, which is very cold.
Well, they always climb it in May, though, right?
Yeah, because the weather window. And when I got to base camp, there was nobody there, you know. So it was, in a way, it's much more stark and atmospheric and more difficult weather-wise.
When you say cold, how cold? At 18,000?
See, it's a different kind of cold. The reason I... when I was on this trip, you never really get warm. So if my socks get wet and I'm sweaty, or my socks are wet because I step in icy water, I have to put my feet by a fire, a real fire. And the boots really never dry properly. And I have to walk. We walk basically 5-6 hours in the morning, and then you stop for lunch. You try to warm up and maybe change your layers because they're wet and cold. And then you walk 5-6 more hours, and you stop at these tea houses where there is no... there's no central heating. There's no, you know, showers. If there are showers, the pipes are frozen. So you get cold and you stay cold. And that's also what makes you physically feel really battered. And it's hard for your core temperature to rise. So it's like so mentally debilitating that you kind of have to be okay with being dirty, or being okay with the physical uncomfortability. When I was on the way down, I had really bloody feet.
From blisters?
From blisters, but also from just my... It's extremely steep, and going downhill, all my toes would be bunching together in my boot.
Uh-huh.
And I had... it's kind of gross. I had my toenails would rub against each other, and the nail would just be cutting it, you know, and... you know, we were in a windstorm, and we fell down a few times, where we turned around at one point. We were walking through the Khumbu Glacier, which, you know, there are crevasses, and this...
people die up there.
People die. I mean, I saw people medically evacuated. I saw people get sick, chest infections. There was... I tell this story quite a bit. There were 31 Australians who were in parallel to my group, which was me, my guide, Suman, and these two Marines who I met. And they were married. That was like their honeymoon, I think.
That's so hard. That's so Marine.
It is. And it was, for me, it was like, well, we can talk about them later because I'm kind of competitive. But it was, the point is, these Australians who were in parallel to us, we would see them on the trail. We'd stop, you know, we'd shoot the shit for a second, and then we'd see them later. Very tough, like, tough guys, very macho. Out of 31, only 19 finished. And that's because they would... chest infections and altitude issues, and you just don't really know what's going to happen up there. And it really strips you of a lot of the pretense and a lot of the macho bullshit, because you really find out in these kind of places and situations who you are, and if something happens, how you're going to react. No one ever knows. We can talk all day long. If this happens, I'll do this. If this happens, I would, you know, El Paso or wherever else, I would have done this. I would have stood up. You know, God forbid anything like that ever happens to you, because we don't know what's going to happen. And when it comes to the mountains, you have to sort of, you know, be prepared, which is, what does that even mean? You have to be so present in the moment by moment and the step by step, and that's how you stay safe. Otherwise, there's so many variables, and if you're the reason that we have so many deaths in places like this, or on Mount Baldy even, you know, here in Southern California, is because people don't take
it
seriously.
People die on Mount Baldy?
People die on Mount Baldy every year.
Really?
They fall off the section called the Devil's Backbone.
Oh.
Because
how high is Baldy?
10,200, 10,000 something.
Have you climbed it?
Yes.
Okay.
Several times. Yeah. That's what I would do. I would train. I've gone back to the Himalayas two more times since then, and I took it much more seriously. And I also went to more difficult areas. With
you
less
like
people.
To climb?
A traditional climber. I don't use ropes and stuff. I don't really know that stuff.
Like the crampons and.
I've used crampons before, but this, you know, carabiners and all this stuff, you know, that makes me nervous, to be honest with you. I have done a lot of stuff where it's free climbing. I've done enough dangerous stuff that I think that, you know, now at where I'm at, in many ways, I don't want to take on a life-threatening sport. It has a shelf life. Everyone gets hurt. I don't like the idea of going to rock walls. I think that's kind of stupid. When I was growing up here in Southern California, I would drag my dad around everywhere, climbing everything. He, poor guy, was such a good sport. But I needed to get that out of my system.
What do you mean dragging him around, climbing everything?
Well, we would go. I'd be like, let's go down this, follow this creek bed up over here. I mean.
Oh, so you were like you were like a kid who wanted to explore.
I wanted to explore, and it didn't matter that there was no trail.
Right.
If there was no trail, it was more appealing to me.
Right.
Let's go explore. There's nobody here. This is more natural. This is more wild. It, you know, looking back, if and when I have a kid, I think, Jesus Christ, again? You know, like dragging me around. And, you know, as an adult, I wanted to, I think, I romanticized these things. And as I was in my 20s and had the chance to be in my own and no supervision, oh, now I can really do these things that are, I don't know what I would call them. I got off on the fact that I would go places no other people had gone before, which is, looking at that, thinking about it, even talking about it, it's immature. You know, it's silly. Maybe I had to do that at that age so I don't do it later. I'm rationalizing maybe. But in terms of this Everest thing, I had no idea what I was getting into. How did
you get the assignment? Because you're a journalist, right? You write for the New York Times, BBC. What else? What are the other big
Washington
ones?
Washington Post, National Geographic, Bloomberg.
How do you get an assignment to go? Like they bankroll you to go to the Himalaya?
No way. I had to pay for that stuff myself.
You did?
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
And then you sell the story to
and
them?
And then I sell the story for peanuts. Yeah.
That's the way it goes.
Sometimes at that point in my career, certainly.
Yeah.
I wanted to go. It was 2013. I was at a period in my life where I had just lost a job or not been picked up again. It was a writing job for what I thought was a big website, news outlet at the time.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I don't even look at that in the same way. But at that moment, I was very proud and I was very ambitious. And I... you know, I was a casualty of the market, or I was not appreciated, or whatever. But
journalism's tough.
Journalism sucks.
Yeah.
You know, it's very hard. It's extremely hard. As is writing, it seems to be everything now. But in this story, in this, you know, 2013, I didn't know anything about this place, but I had wanted to go, yeah, okay. I got some email, I think, about some eco trip that was, you know, go to base camp in 12 days or 14 days for $1,200 or 14, whatever it was, $2,000, something like that. I thought, okay, all right, well, I can do that. And then I started talking to these people out there. There was a U.S. rep and set up this trip and flew there and, you know, and just sort of winged it. And I had done a lot of solo travel and lived a bit by myself abroad. And
whereabouts?
In Italy, in northern Italy, in Parma, the city of cheese and ham. And, you know, I certainly rolled the dice. And I think whether it's you're taking on a novel for the first time and never had done it before, or you're embarking on maybe a baby or whatever it is, you have to have a measure of confidence whether or not you know what the hell you're getting into or not. And you got to say, listen, I'm going to figure it out. And for most life choices, I think whatever happens, you're probably going to get your way out of the you know, that situation, and you'll probably be safe. This one, you know, this is a little more extreme.
You were always,
but it matched my personality.
You were always only going to go to 18,000 feet.
Correct. It was always to base camp.
You were never thinking like I'm going to summit. You're not going to summit in December.
The thing is, when you're there on the way up, and during that time period, I was thinking, well, you know, maybe I would climb to the top. Maybe I can do that, and I think I could do that. I don't want to do that.
I don't either.
It's stupid is the real truth.
Okay.
It's so dangerous and it's so expensive and time-wise, I can't afford to lose a finger. I can't afford to lose 6 months or a year of my time also at this period. And it's also miserable.
Right.
You know, I got what I needed out of that experience. I've been back to the mountain since. But for me, the big payoff is not I'm at the top of the mountain and look, I'm better than you guys and I'm tougher. No, that's the immature young man that I want to shed that skin.
Right.
Now I'm into the food. I'm into making friends out there and the culture. I'm into actually learning about a place and not have to run to the top and say, nah, 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 here I am. And I've been back for the last few years and I actually have made some friends and have, you know, stay up with them. And I've been going to,
like Nepali friends or,
well, so I've been back to Nepal, but I've also been to northern India, to Jammu and Kashmir, which has been in the news a lot. And I went looking for snow leopards the last 2 years.
You read Peter Matheson's book?
I did read that book. I was sort of mixed about that book because...
And we're talking about Peter Matheson's memoir,
and
The Snow Leopard.
It's a great book, but when I learned more about Matheson and some people I've, you know, you when you meet your heroes, sometimes they disappoint you. And in his respect, excuse me, for Matheson, I was kind of upset at, I felt like it was sometimes disingenuous, that book. And it was so navel-gazing for me at times that I felt felt it was a bit repetitive in places. And the way that he depicts this George Schaller, who is the... In a way, his guru who takes him through the mountains. George Schaller is a guy I've interviewed before, and he is very tough and dry, and he's like an old goat in a lot of ways. But I don't know.
Where does he live?
He's German originally. I think he lives in the East Coast somewhere. I think Maryland or something.
Oh, okay. So he's not like over there in the Himalayas.
No. He is a guy who also has a very, his politics, he's been criticized a lot for some of the things, the way he's treated China, and because he's gotten so much access to Tibet, and that's a whole other conversation. But in terms of Matheson, and relating to my book, I didn't want to read another story about a Westerner looking with that prism. Of course, I am a Westerner looking with that prism, but I didn't want the narrative to depict that same thing. I wanted something a little different.
Well, that's what your novel's trying to rectify. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but your novel is trying to... explore this idea and this reality that there is quite a lot more than just, you know, Westerners and people from other places coming to climb Mount Everest and stay on this trail and go to these base camps and hang out on this mountain and, you know, probably try to summit it. It's a huge place with millions and millions of people and like a rich culture, and it's an endangered place.
Right.
And that's what you're doing, right?
Well, I thought it was more interesting, you know, what's going on with these overlooked groups. I mean, you're walking past these small villages. What is life like on this mountain that's so known for what? For the top? For this perilous death march? Does anyone even care about that? Why is that so much allure? There's so many other mountains that are 100 feet less or more challenging or more beautiful, but we don't care about that because we maximize the top, the most, the whatever, the Everest of, you know, bicycles, the Everest of a stack of books in your nightstand. I mean, it becomes this catch-all. And
like whatever's the highest,
that's not the most interesting part. There's so many more interesting things to me about what life might be like there, because in many ways you're trapped in these mountains. You're not allowed to have the things First off, they've never seen the ocean. You know, they've never seen a city. There's no cars up there. There's minimal education. There's minimal opportunity. That, to me, was the canvas. And then, of course, we have this backdrop of this romantic notion of this mountain that attracts all these flies.
And, yeah, and you have, like, all these people, these hyper-competitive, mostly bros, but some women, too, who are trying to do what I would say it's like a frivolous thing. Like, they invest it with, or I don't want to, like, rain on anybody's parade. Like, people have their enthusiasms, right? People have their things. Maybe some people really love, like, summiting mountains. You know, they love to climb and test themselves. But the danger, not only to their lives, but also what's happening to the ecosystem there, it just seems like, I don't know, there's something about it that fundamentally depresses me. Like, it seems silly to me. And there's some aspect of human nature that I think it brings into focus that is ultimately not helpful.
Well, it's very complicated, because if you think about the economic landscape in a place, whether it be Everest or Aspen or what have you, a lot of the livelihoods do revolve around mountain culture of some kind. And it does feed a lot of livelihoods. You know, Everest in particular, you know, these Sherpas who are the ones, as the so-called ice doctors, who are putting the ladders and laying the ropes and all that stuff. Tremendously risky, yes. Well paid. Actually, sometimes it is quite well paid, especially for the $2 a day economy, which Nepal is one of the poorest countries in the world. There also is a huge honor among that culture. If you've reached the top of this mountain, you're a celebrity there, and you're a celebrity there in a different way than us, because that mountain has a lot of holiness. It's considered to be very. There's a lot of religion involved with it, which is why also people there believe that the reason there's been so many tragedies over the last few years is because the mountain is being abused. The mountain is being trashed, and a lot of that, they're looking past what the culture should be and taking advantage of it. And they're in an impossible situation, because how could you not, if you have limited options? This is the same issue that's happening in so many places across the world, where they're forced by so much circumstance to mortgage that future and to betray maybe a value system, because they're just trying to be a good parent. They're trying to feed their kids.
They're trying to eat.
And you know what? And you come from the West, and they want to make you feel good, and you probably will feel good. And it's so complicated that we, from here, we say, well, that's wrong, or this is the way it should be. And you go to these places, and life is more complicated, and for a novelist, it is an extremely rich palette. For a journalist, it's more challenging, because you're not allowed to make editorializations, and you're not allowed to really deviate and give your own impression so much, unless it's a travelogue. So that is the dichotomy, and it made me want to explore and take a risk and experiment. And that's why I wanted to depict a woman, because if we have a stand-in for me as a Western male, we've seen that before. It's not as interesting. If we even have a Sherpa who's a male, we expect that. If we have a Sherpa who's a female, oh man, I mean, it's so much more rich, and there's so much to explore there.
Well, and you know, you talk about these Sherpas and the way that they achieve a kind of celebrity in Nepal if they've had success climbing Everest. I think it's arguable that the best alpine climbers in the world are these Sherpas. Like, these people go through
100%.
Like, no oxygen.
Or the Incas, or any, you know, mountain people, that their lungs are physically bigger. Their hearts are bigger. It's evolutionary.
Right. But, I mean, they can perform on the mountain in ways like Westerners coming, even like these dudes who are like biohacking and hyper trained and physically fit.
Some of these guys really don't do well. Those, and I mean, what's awesome, listen, if you grew up in Santa Barbara, you might be a great surfer because you did it all your life.
Right.
It's similar to that. I mean, I've seen guys who are in flat vans, you know, marching up the mountain like it's nothing. And it's fucking amazing.
It's unbelievable.
I had a buddy. I went to college in Colorado, and I came from the Midwest, which is flat as a board. And I remember one of my buddies had grown up in Telluride, and we went on a mountain bike ride. And, like, I was a pretty good athlete, and he was crushing me. And I was like, what is going on? He's like, I have mountain legs. Mm-hmm. He just grew up in it. I mean, Telluride's at 9,000 feet. So he grew up at 9,000 feet. That gives you an advantage.
It does. And also, you know, so last year, 2018, I went to spend about a month back in the Himalayas. And this time, as I previously mentioned, in Jammu and Kashmir. So this is the border region between India and Pakistan.
Which is like...
still the Himalayas.
It's a crisis point, though, like politically.
Crisis point. Another very complicated region because it's a huge, huge area. And not everywhere is... insurgents, and it's not like that. It's like saying when someone says, oh, you're going to the U.S., there was just a shooting in El Paso. Well, okay, that's true. We do have a serious issue with guns. But you staying at the Regency or you going to hike the Pacific Coast Trail or whatever,
yeah,
you're going to probably be okay.
Right.
You know, it's a vast area.
Sure.
But anyhow, going there this last year, you know, the Karakoram is a part of the Himalaya range. And I sort of just lost track of what I was saying before, but the point is this thing is just, you know, this place is, it hooks you.
I was going to say, you clearly love it.
I love it. And then, so last year when I put up camera traps looking for snow leopards, another assignment that I twisted the arm of people to say, let me go do that. Okay. You know, I'm paying my own way again. So it's very little investment on the part of an editor. So putting up camera traps at 16,000 feet, you know, no trails on this stuff, going up mountains. I went with the same guy who took the BBC Planet Earth team to go find leopards. I mean, this is for me as a kid or me as an adult, I'm excited. This is a peak experience.
Where does this come from?
You
grew up in Southern California, so it's
well,
not like
we have mountains and we do have beautiful nature. It's listen, you know, you embark on a quest in your life, and some way or another, you manage to start building like Lego blocks, and you keep pushing and you keep doing. And what I was trying to explain was that, you know, last year to this year, my performance out there. Big improvement.
Okay.
And I have taken it a lot more seriously in terms of my training and trying to really know as best I can to mimic the conditions. You can't do everything, but, you know, hiking Baldy, hiking, you know, these peaks around here.
How far away is Baldy from LA?
About 45 minutes east.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty close.
I should go do that.
You should go do that. I mean, it's the thing is, it's also, you know... trying to be out there enough. Listen, these are like hard places. You don't just show up, you know. You got to be outdoors a lot to be comfortable. Because if you have no Wi-Fi, you have no bathroom. You know, there are people who freak out.
What do you just like? You squat in the snow.
Maybe you don't squat in the snow, but you're definitely not flushing if you're even using a bathroom or a toilet.
Right.
And like that's it's not to go to be in hardship. That's not an appeal. You go because you might be able to see a snow leopard.
Did you see one?
I fucking saw one.
Did you really?
It took 2 years, okay? It took 2 years to visually see it. I had it on my cameras.
Just so people listening understand, like snow leopards are notorious for being elusive and hard to spot.
They're very hard to spot. You're not supposed to see them. I'll tell you what I did see the 2 years in a row was wolves.
Really?
I saw wolves very close up.
What's the species variation?
It's a Tibetan wolf.
Uh-huh.
It's a smaller wolf.
They're kind of cute, right?
They actually look kind of mangy.
Oh, really?
It's a tough environment.
Maybe it's the Tibetan fox I'm thinking of.
That one is so beautiful. It doesn't even look real.
It's adorable.
They have this very round face. It looks like a Disney character.
Right.
Listen, I'm telling you, these places, you find a way to get to them. They hook you. And it's you go while you can. You know, you try to do it in a safe way. You try to do... in a way that makes sense financially or professionally. I don't have some of these obligations that other people have.
Yeah, you can go.
You know, I can go. I still have to make my nut every month and pay the bills. But if I go to some place, I usually sell a story first. I have a couple other potentials, and I come back and I sell two or three out of it. So it makes sense financially for me. But it's hard time-wise and investment-wise.
Well, yeah.
It's hard on the body, too.
Yeah, but I imagine being over there is fairly cheap. Like, you don't have to spend a ton of money to stay there, right?
Well, you know, it certainly adds up. And, you know, sometimes it is expensive. Sometimes it's really expensive because having the right gear, having the right clothes.
Right.
And then sometimes also I splurge on my flights where I sometimes upgrade.
Yeah.
Air China, you can upgrade on the flight for cash.
Can you really?
You really can.
You're like, I just want to fucking lie down and just sleep.
That's so important.
Right.
It's so important if you sleep on the plane and you get there and you're sharper, you don't have as bad of a jet lag.
No, I'm with you on that. I'm with you. So let's talk about this snow leopard.
Yeah.
2 years.
Yeah. I can show you on my phone. Oh, man.
So you're setting up cameras in the wild at 16,000 feet?
Yeah, 16,000 feet. I would go every day with these guys who would... Think of it like this. We have mountain lions in the mountains around here. So if you live in Azusa or Glendale or whatever, maybe you're on some trails and maybe you've seen some lions. Maybe you've seen some scat or some what's called pug marks because their hind legs scrape the ground. These are indicators of the animal. Or you see a deer kill. You keep going and frequenting these locations, you may see a lion. You may not. But if you set up a camera there and put it on a kill, good chance you're going to see a lion. So it's that kind of habitual behavior. And if you go with locals and people who, it's their backyard, you know, there's no guarantees for wildlife, but there can be good chances. And if you're willing to, you know, hike your butt up to some peak and walk around on some ridgeline and not look backwards and keep yourself about you and not get hurt. If you don't get hurt, no one can really tell you you're an idiot. If you get hurt, you're an idiot.
That's the litmus test.
That's the test. It really is. Whatever you do as an adult.
Yeah.
If you fuck up, they were right.
Yeah.
If you don't, you know what?
They were
even
wrong.
If it didn't, you know, make my dream come true, I'm at neutral, you know?
So you caught the lion on camera is what you're saying.
So the leopard,
leopard, I'm sorry.
We got it. I got the first images I got. We found a cow, a dead cow. And I put up cameras there at about like 4:15 p.m. And
are they nocturnal?
They are crepuscular. So dawn and dusk. But they are very much, you know, they sleep almost all day.
Yeah.
But when I first got, we found a kill and we set up these cameras around it. And there was a fox, a red fox, same red fox as you might see in like London.
Hmm.
It's an amazing species that is so well adapted to everything. Anyway, a red fox was on the kill 5 minutes after I left, because you can see on the timestamp on the camera. That night, a very scared and skittish wolf was on the kill. And on my cameras, we saw the leopard come, scare off the wolf, and the leopard was on the kill.
Wow. You got good pictures?
You know, I'm a writer. Do I really know how to take good pictures?
Yeah, come on, dude.
I mean, some of them are social media-wise pretty good.
Yeah.
Some of these have been published in, you know, Bloomberg and the Washington Post or whatever. The thing is, my pictures versus a professional
photographer. Like the guys who are doing
National Geographic stuff?
Yeah, Planet Earth or whatever.
So there was a guy there who was shooting a National Geographic special, and his pictures versus my pictures are night and day, you know? Also, at nighttime, especially, there is a guy named Steve Winter, who's a very famous Nat Geo photographer. He has come up with some of these camera traps.
I'm calling
to do really
bullshit
nice.
On that last name, by the way.
Steve Winter?
Yeah.
Look him up. He's.
It's got to be a pen name or something, right?
It's too perfect.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be like Dan Lionsman or something. But this guy has basically it's a backlight. Because if you have the backlight when they come, you're not going to see the glare in the eyes. And it's a big difference.
Yeah.
But this last year, I finally saw a leopard visual with my two eyes, not on a camera. And again, this was, you know, unexpected. We were following some injured a yak that was attacked by a leopard. The yak had a huge gash mark here. We followed a blood trail. We sat on some ridge, scanning, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour, getting really cold. I start talking, start making jokes, and started, you know, we're not saying anything. Let's go have dinner. Let's get out of here. And this guy named Stanzen, who is the son of Norbu, who's he's the guide, and he's the leopard tracker. He's like, really knows wildlife with an eye. It's unbelievable. Anyway, Stanzen looks up, and he's like, leopard, leopard, leopard. And we, you know, freak out and look in the binoculars and the scopes. And it's twilight, and there's this leopard on top of a ridge looking down on us. And he can see the yak and our group. And it seems like not even real and regal and beautiful and looks large. Maybe he only weighs 80 pounds, you know, but looks... It looks solid and almost robotic too, almost like not real. And it was sort of an emotional moment, to be honest with you, because you spend so much time looking for these things, and even if I get them on video or a camera, it's different than being there.
Yeah, it's like taking a picture of the moon. You look at the photo and you're like, well, that doesn't measure up unless you have the right camera.
It's real. It actually exists. And it's special. Special.
I remember watching on one of those Planet Earths, I think, where they're tracking a snow leopard, and they get one, and there's a long shot like across a ravine, basically. It's like from one side of from one mountain wall to another mountain wall is essentially the shot. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. And what struck me is that even if the leopard is there and it's relatively close,
you might not see it.
It's hard to see.
So here's something about Matheson that goes back to the leopard, snow leopard book you alluded to. He has a good comment. He says, you know, I'm not paraphrasing. He says that you don't have to see it, but to be there is enough, or to be around it is enough. And I use that that's a rationalization. And especially as a writer, you want to have that reveal, whether it's an article or a book. You're after this quest. It's a quest book. And you don't find the amulet, the ark, the whatever. You want to have that. And when I first went there, I was thinking to myself, you know what? They're probably looking at me right now. You know, they probably see me. It's good enough I'm here. After a while, you start to feel like you feel like upset. You want to see it. You need to get that cathartic, you know, you need to reach the end of your quest. And seeing the leopard, I was like, oh, my God. You really feel like you put a lot into it, because I saw everything but the leopard.
Did you get closure? Like, what did you feel once you saw the leopard, were you like, okay,
well,
I'm done?
I'll tell you, my people close to me said, have you had enough? Are you going to go back? And the first thing I said was, you know what, I think I have had enough for him now. But it's almost been 9 months, and now I'm thinking about
going back.
My next trip. And it's funny, because when I'm there, I think to myself, because I enjoy sleeping in a bed. I enjoy splurging and being in a hotel. All these things. It's not like it's not fun being in pain.
Right.
You know, it's not fun. You do it for, you know, the small moments there. You do it for sometimes even looking back, things that were difficult or more fun. Writing a book, for instance. I mean, we don't write a book because we're sitting there in the room and it's fun to edit, and it's fun to be rejected or have self-doubt or think, Jesus Christ, how am I going to really do this? It's fun that moments like this, where we can talk about it and we can reflect on it, where we actually gain something from it, maybe some understanding of ourselves or the world or whatever, and then we propel that forward and use it.
Yeah, no, it's funny how it, like, you know, in hindsight, it can be easy to romanticize things that at the time were really difficult. And there's something to be said for, like, what's the old adage? Like, I like having written, you know, as opposed to writing.
Totally. Maybe that's a genetic thing where, as for part of our evolution, we have had to use memory in a way that if we internalized every traumatic moment and still experienced it and really still were there, how do you live? How do you go about daily life?
No, you got to weed it out. You know, your system, your brain has to sift through these things. You can't carry it all. But I am also struck by how even the difficult things, like things that were challenging or uncomfortable or that tested you, like, I'm not talking about awful, like trauma, but I'm talking about like just tough stuff, you know, where you're out and it's 30 below, or you're, you know, you're dealing with some injury and you push through or whatever it is, that stuff often in the rearview mirror is the stuff that sticks the most and that you have the most like reverence for and appreciation for.
I think so too. But I think that in hindsight, I've said a lot of things that were character forming, or I think to myself, well, that taught me this and now I'm this. And now I'm sort of a mind to think, you know, would I want my kids to go through some of the things I've went through? No.
Right.
Maybe they will be softer, but maybe that's the better way to be. Maybe it's better to not carry so much stuff around. Maybe, you know, I have managed to forge a career as a writer, but would I be more happy or maybe more normal or whatever if I was had a 9-to-5? I mean, sure, I wouldn't go to Kashmir and see leopards, but maybe, you know, that's outlier stuff. That is stuff that I've sort of, I'm very aware that that's not normal, but I'm thinking to myself, you know, there could have been different ways. And is this the best way? I mean, it is where I am.
I think everybody feels that way. Like we all like sort of mourn the lives we didn't lead. You can't do it all. You got to make choices.
For artists, I think it's a very, very internalized thing. And I don't know if a lot of people talk about it. And I certainly think a lot of people, I think a lot of artists do sort of romanticize. Yeah, it's really hard. And I know I don't get paid good, but, you know, I do it because I love the word. I mean, thinking like, wait a second. What really makes you do something?
It's interesting that you bring this up because I was just having a conversation before you came over with a pal of mine about this, and it's something I've said before, probably on this show, but certainly to myself, and I think most people listening have probably come across it, but it's worth repeating, is that having whatever project you're working on, if we're talking about writers, you know, whatever creative project or professional ambition or personal ambition that you're pursuing, having a clear understanding of why you're doing it is really important, especially if you're going to undertake something that requires a lot of you, particularly when it comes to like stamina, you know, something that's going to like, you have to invest in writing a book for years of your life. Often, if you don't know why you're doing it, you might finish the book, but I doubt it will be as good as it otherwise would have been. And if you aren't finishing, maybe you're not clear on why. And I'm saying that to myself as much as I'm saying it to mm-hmm. the audience or to you.
I think the mechanics of the actual business are just as interesting as the mechanics on the page and the sentence structure. Because how do you find a way when people say, yeah, I spent 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, I think to myself, how did that even happen? How do you spend so long on something and then meanwhile, how are you financially solvent?
Yeah.
And that's a big one, because how do you grow your craft and yet still pay the bills while you're developing and getting good? Because it takes forever. I feel like it's taken me so long to get here. I thought I was good a long time ago. I know now I wasn't. You know, I thought I was good. And I needed to, I think, be, when I was 16, I wrote a screenplay. I thought I was going to drop out of school. I got very close to optioning it. Good thing I didn't option it. I would have been a fuck up. I would have burned out so fast. I needed to fail there. I needed to go not go to college immediately and not get into colleges and make so many mistakes to see who I really am, and then to be able to use that. And I'm not like, again, I'm not saying the failure is the way to do it. But I think when people come out of school and they go immediately, I'm a writer now, it's important to live a life. It's important to have experiences that are very varied. And a lot of people who have been in MFA programs or what have you, I mean, I think that they don't have a rapport with people from multiple classes and multiple experiences, which are so important to be able to inhabit those in a convincing way.
Right. Well, yeah, if you're going to write about it, I mean, I think about trying to write, for example, like a young girl who tries to defy the social order in the Himalayas and be a Sherpa, you know, the way that you've depicted in your book. And I don't know how you would even begin to attempt that unless you'd been there.
Well, even, listen, I also thought, what can I do as a first novel? I wanted to write this as nonfiction. I actually wrote a nonfiction book, full book.
Oh, really?
Okay. And I was told by agents, and I was very eager and I was so excited and put a lot of time into this while still being a full-time journalist, which is, you know, mentally, that's challenging.
Yeah.
It's tiring.
Yeah. You know? Only have so much juice every day.
Man, but again, you want it, you have to try because you'll never know. But I wrote it as a nonfiction book first, and I was, you know, it was my experience. Was it interesting? Probably. Was it a good book? It might have been a good book, but the problem with it is no one dies in the book, and we don't go to the summit. So from a marketing and sales perspective, the reader might feel like it wasn't high stakes enough.
That's right, stakes.
So I took that and gestated that and felt it, and I went to think, okay, how do I tell a story in this world which fascinates me so much and I think will fascinate readers? And I decided to really take a gamble, and I thought, well, this is, in a way, a bad choice because of our knee-jerk reaction moment we're in right now. But this was a couple years ago, and I wasn't even thinking that way because that would inhibit me too much. And I really thought that this is the character I wanted to inhabit, and this is a viewpoint I wanted to take, you know, for better or worse. And of course I took liberties. Of course, that's what a writer does. You base certain things on reality, but you have to be able to birth something.
So for a guy who has worked as a journalist primarily throughout his career, you suddenly embark on writing fiction, get through it, finish the book, publish the book. You know, with some perspective now looking back, do you feel like, you know, writing fiction and sort of using a different part of your brain maybe or different tools strengthened you as a journalist?
Totally.
Like, what did you learn from that, like, process?
So it's been a strange reaction or reception. A lot of journalists say, well, why did you write a fiction? As if that's somehow cheating or not as...
But don't a lot of journalists secretly harbor ambitions to
write a
novel?
I think they do.
Or maybe not so secretly.
I think they do. And I think that because so few journalists write fiction, because if you're doing a story, God, you have to be so... It causes a lot of anxiety because you have to get someone else's life right.
Yeah.
Multiple people in one story, even if it's something small. Everything, you know? And I think journalists are very wed to this so-called truth with the capital T. And I think it inhibits a lot of... it inhibits an outlook on the world. It's either this or this. If you're this group, this is your narrative. And I think that that's quite stifling. And fiction, I think... you can see the world maybe for what it really is. I don't have a solution to every problem. I don't need to make this character is the bad guy of the story. This is the good guy. There is motivations that every bad guy is the hero of their own story. You know, everyone has, we do things because we're put in situations where there is no better answer. And I have to choose one of the two. And according to the law or according to culture or whatever, that's wrong. And I think that, you know, it helps my journalism, but the editors don't want to see my take. They want it to just be story of X or whatever and highlight that.
So did you ever think about abandoning the project after the nonfiction version didn't turn out?
Well, 2016, I tore my ACL.
Where?
Basketball court.
Oh, okay. Like not like up on
no,
Everest.
No, not over there, thank God.
I was chasing a snow leopard at 18,000 feet.
Yeah, I was trying to be Indiana Jones and right. Whatever. That was a really traumatic, horrible experience.
You play basketball a lot?
I sure did.
Yeah.
You know, now I'm more careful, you know, if at all.
You know what? I wanted to talk about that for a second.
Sure.
And so just like, I don't mean to interject, but before I forget... you talked about having to really be a present in order to avoid injury.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an undervalued. I think it's undervalued, not just in the context of like high alpine climbing, but life in general.
Like, wait, sorry, I'm looking down on my
phone.
Yeah,
that's but that's it, right? Like avoiding accidents, car accidents.
How about just looking at someone in the eye, you know, or smiling at someone with, for no intention, just to you catch eye contact and not to feel inhibited where I have to look down on my phone.
Like when you, like when I'm walking and I, you never do that where you're like walking and you like stub your toe on like a curb or a, you know, piece of the sidewalk that's elevated or whatever it is. And you're like, oh, and you trip.
No,
and you almost...
I don't do that because I'm on the ridgeline looking for leopards. No, right. But of course.
Your system is finely tuned. You have seen a snow leopard,
right.
You know,
sorry.
A sidewalk is not going to trip you up. But I just notice it. And I say to myself, because this is the way that I think, I'm like, wow, if I ever get to an advanced age, you know how old people are always falling, they break their hip or something. And I was like, well, you get, the reason that happens is, well, part of it is physical deterioration. But any human being, whatever age, when that is happening, it's because you're not
aware.
Most likely because you're not tuned in.
Yeah.
So
my mom just broke her foot because she was walking down the stairs and was looking at her phone. And I'm sorry, I'm not trying to embarrass her. I know she is embarrassed about it, but it was a totally unavoidable or totally avoidable thing.
Right.
It's just because you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
And how many accidents or something we see, those are unforced errors.
Right. So if you want to avoid, the point I'm trying to make, you want to avoid injury.
Pay attention.
I feel like the most obvious thing ever. So you were raised in Southern California. What part?
I was raised in West LA.
West LA.
It's very general.
Yeah. Like what, Santa Monica?
No, I was raised first in Hollywood, and then we moved to Beverly Hills.
Okay.
Yeah.
How was that? Like Beverly Hills High
kind
of thing?
Well, I mean, it is... So my parents are both immigrants.
From?
My mom was born in Israel. And my father was born in Romania.
Okay.
Both of them, well, my father had to escape to come to the U.S., and my mom's family were also refugees. So growing up in L.A. for me was very much feeling like an outsider. And a lot of...
So you're first generation.
First generation. A lot of these things are... subsurface. Now, I'm at a point in my life where I can compartmentalize things. But as a kid, when you're growing up raised by people with accents, not so much my mom, but my father and my grandparents, you know, and a lot of normal stuff that kids do with their dad, we didn't do, you know.
Like what?
Play sports.
But he was chasing you around creek beds and
he
stuff.
Was doing that, but... You know, I there's shame wrapped up into it. There's feelings of being different, which feeds creativity in a strange way because you have an outside perspective or you feel other. But I don't know. We had a lot of issues growing up. You know,
you have siblings?
I have one sister who's much more well adjusted than I am.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she sure is.
Good for her.
Good for her is right. I mean,
she's got a stable job. She's not
she
chasing.
Does.
She's
she
not
does.
Chasing endangered species
no,
around the planet.
She's smarter. She's smarter than me in that respect. You know, both my parents were writers or are writers.
Oh, interesting.
And
what kind?
Both novelists and TV.
No
and
shit.
Film. So, which means high highs and low lows.
Right.
And
what did they do anything we would know about?
Well, you sure, damn sure should know about it, Mr. well, my father has a Wikipedia page. So, my father has written several bestsellers in English. He also had a career in Romania where he was a communist country. He was one of the preeminent writers, novelists of his era. He had to escape in 1973. John Cheever helped him come to the U.S., who was a big writer at one point. And
sure.
He went to the University of Iowa, where he was...
He went to the workshop?
He went to the workshop, my father, and was a fellow or something of that nature, and finally got to the U.S. after bouncing around to England and Australia and had to learn to write in a new language, which is, you know, Nabokov and... A couple of those. It's extremely difficult,
right.
And has had bestsellers in English. One of them was called Almost Adam, which came out already in like 1996. But that was about an American paleontologist who goes to East Africa, discovers a living hominid, and as a scientist, do I expose these people to the world, or do I protect them? And it was a bestseller in the Times bestseller list. He has written extensively mining our family history. My grandparents on my mom's side met in a concentration camp and escaped.
That's quite a place to meet.
Yes, it is. And he wrote about it in a book for St. Martin's Press. It was called The Oasis, which Elie Wiesel and Salman Rushdie, I believe, also endorsed at the time. He has a new book. I'm proud of my father. Yeah. He's my favorite author.
Yeah.
He's my favorite author. And he has given me so much respect for words, respect for the craft. And he's you know, I think the best teacher is not someone who just gives you an A for showing up. He kept me honest, and he is not afraid or has not been afraid to tell me when I've made mistakes. We're working on something right now. After I'm here, I'm going to go to see him because we're editing something.
Oh, really?
You know,
a book?
Something else.
What is it?
It's a screenplay.
Oh.
Actually based on one of his books. So,
interesting.
Yeah, that I adapted. And he actually had, I'll tell you the last thing and I'll stop plugging away and I'll mention my mom really quick. But there's he wrote a book called Amazon Beaming. And it was about, this is a true story, a National Geographic explorer who goes to South America, meets an uncontacted Indian tribe, and gets kidnapped by them, has to escape, and then finds the source of the Amazon River. I mean, so this is me growing up hearing these kind of stories, sometimes traveling with them, you know, on research trips.
Did he take you places?
Took me places.
Like where?
The Amazon.
So now it's making more sense that
these things were less scary to me. I mean, certainly you go in with your parents and the measure of luxury, it's also exciting. But as I grew up, I had a taste for this stuff and I thought, you know, you want to get more.
Yeah.
And my mom wrote a lot of TV movies with my dad and several, teleplays and, you know, so. Growing up with them, there was respect for this stuff, but there was also it's certain disdain for it because I could see from them the business and how utterly merceless and arbitrary
it wasn't romanticized.
It wasn't because you still have to make it work, mm-hmm. you know, and that's why I am maybe critical in a way, and I just think I'm real. I feel very real about it, and it might be my first book, but I've been writing professionally for almost 10 years now as a journalist, and growing up seeing my parents do it, I mean, they told me, it's not that they didn't encourage me, but they said, you don't have to do this. You can do anything else. And I think if my parents were something else, I probably would have pursued something else. Part of my personality with the book, with whatever, has been a bit rebellious, and if someone says I can't do it, I try to find a way to do it, for better or worse. It's not that I wrote a book with a female character to say nah 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 nah, like I am a male but I can still do this. No, I wanted to do it because I thought it was so challenging and so outside of what's me that was exciting and the character that I wanted to create.
Well, it's also the most interesting creative choice to you.
I think so. And the fact is, what's the time we're living in right now is when Bret Easton Ellis came on this show and he was talking about some of the issue he takes with a degree of censorship is a big word. And I don't want to use that word, but there is a sense of who is allowed to tell certain stories or who is allowed to act, or there's a lot of stuff rolled up into this.
Like policing of, like that's the part of, I think, his politics where I find some agreement is, like, I get uneasy around the policing of creativity. And, you know, if policing is the right word, but it's like, who gets to be that? Who gets that role?
I think the role of the writer is to be a voice of reason in an unreasonable world, is to shine a mirror back of what's going on. But I think that in my instance with this book right now, which is, I find quite ironic and quite challenging at times, is people think that they know my story, or that they say, well, here's a privileged white male. You know, I wish I was more privileged. I wish I was more white, is the real truth. Because depending on...
You look pretty white.
Well, I'm a Jew.
Yeah.
I'm forever being in the shadows. I'm forever normalizing myself or being around people who Let me tell you, it's heavy. It's heavy, and it's not just an academic thing. It's very, very close to my family. You know, people being murdered, not, you know, a generation ago.
Yeah.
To be raised by that and to feel that.
That's a psychic burden.
It's not only a psychic burden, it makes it that it's not something to use as a card. It's something that I don't like to talk about because it trivializes it. Not everyone needs to know the pain. Not everyone needs to know all these deep things. And we all have them, no matter what color, whatever. But right now in this moment, it is almost like there's us versus them, and every group seems to have to collectivize a narrative where it's like being in middle school and people don't want to sit at each other's table. It's getting weird, and it's not helpful. And at least from my experience, I mean, my family, whatever way you want to cut it on both sides, we've been the oppressed, not the oppressor. So when people say that to me that you haven't had to dealt with anything, and what do you know about this? Wait a second, what do you know about me? It really shouldn't matter at all who I am. The book should stand up. Does it work or not? But if we want to have that conversation, you know, I think we can have that, and I'll tell you things that'll blow you away, you know, and I don't need to do that to prove it. I don't need to go on social media and be a warrior.
Yeah.
These are things that you internalize that you come out in other ways, in more meaningful ways, not to prove something.
Right. Yeah, and I think, you know, maybe the larger point is that everybody's shit happens to everybody. No one's as simple as they might seem to you when you're evaluating them on social media or just.
Well, that's why I was saying, wouldn't it be better if it was? I mean, we wouldn't have to internalize so much stuff. I don't think my kids will the same way as I have.
Yeah, they'll be a generation removed.
They'll be more assimilated. Because right. That's the big difference between also American Jews and I think Jews who are recent immigrants is the assimilation.
Right.
You know?
Well, and you know, you know, your family history and your personal history embodies a lot of human experience. You know, like there's been your parents have traveled a long way
right.
in their lifetimes from being immigrants on the run, in exile, or whatever,
mm-hmm.
to getting to, you know, being creative professionals in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
Doing well in a very tough business. Like that's
South Beverly Hills, but still.
Yeah, but still, the point I'm trying to make, and I have...
No, it's amazing. What other country can this happen? Canada, maybe the UK.
Right. But it doesn't happen very often.
No, it doesn't.
It does happen. It does happen, but it doesn't happen very often, and I relate to it just because... my dad was the first person in his family to go to college,
mm-hmm.
and he did really well.
Mm-hmm.
But I also remember going down to see I grew up in a suburban Milwaukee in a aluminum siding house. Like I grew up very middle class, comfortable, but middle class. I remember going down to Louisiana to see my grandparents, and they would be like very lower middle class. And I saw a lot of indigence,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I was, I don't know, like I just... it's not the same, but it is kind of the same. Just covering a lot of different like layers of human experience and having some access to it all, and then trying to process it and make some sense of it. For me, it can be like a little bit head spinny sometimes. Like to know, like
who am I?
Who am I? Yeah, you know. So before I let you go, I'm interested to know if like the spiritual juju. Mm-hmm. of that part of the world over in the Himalayas and Nepal and India. Is that any part of the allure for you, or did you pick it up while you were there?
I mean, I certainly try to imbue it in the book.
Yeah.
I read a lot of important texts. I know that you have some leanings towards Buddhism.
Yeah.
I tried to think so much of that, the Buddhist mindset about the impermanence of life and about maybe a detachment from death in a way where it's so part of life. It's I tried to really make that come about in the mentality of the character, and just touch on how did I build this character You know, it wasn't like one person I met. It wasn't like that. But I thought about if I had never gone past third grade or second grade, I have my father is a Sherpa, and I am the firstborn of my family. I am not married at an age where I should be married. I have never seen a city. There's so many things I tried to think in that kind of mindset. I would listen to Radio Kantapur, which is a city in Nepal, and it had a 24-hour, you know, news and music. I tried to really be there as much as I could. And I thought, like, the Buddhist way of looking at the world appealed to me. And I'm not Buddhist, but that terms of, you know, when you're up in those mountains, there are moments that no matter what religion you are, you do feel spiritual and you do feel small and part of something that's connected and complicated. And you're just a speck on the side of this mountain. And this rock under you has been here for 300,000 years and will be here for another 200,000. And you're going to be gone in a blink of an infinitesimal blink in the greater cosmic story.
Right.
How could you not feel these things? And how could it not course through you seeing sunrises with a pink sunrise with a mountain behind it or in front of it?
The mountains are great.
They're so evocative.
Yeah.
They're so exciting.
Yeah.
Unless you're overnight on one.
Yeah.
But when you wake up in the morning with a tea or something, you know, that
you
can appreciate it.
I have a lot of love for it. I got the bug when I was in college and it's never left me. Like, I still hike. And like, I was talking to my wife and I was like, you know, if we ever did leave Los Angeles, like, I got to live somewhere where there's a mountain. I've had a mountain to climb, like in some form since I was 18 years old.
It's a great metaphor.
Yeah. I got it. If I didn't have one, I think I would be upset. Did the Buddhist culture of Nepal and, you know, the Himalayas, did that factor into your decision to use first person present tense in the book?
I think first person as a reader, if I like the character, I really like first person because I think first person in the novel format in general, there is no other medium that allows you to think that person's thoughts. And that was a serious turn on for me.
What about writing a female character? Did you have like females in your life who were vetting it to try to make sure you were
accurate? 100%. 100%. My mom, my sister, my girlfriend.
What does your sister do? Is she like an accountant? Did she do
no,
something?
No, she's an agent.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
She's not a talent agent. She's a digital agent, which...
She represent podcasters?
Well, she might know a thing or two.
Did she blow up my career? Let's do this.
I told you my number, buddy.
Well, I congratulate you on
Thank
it. And
you.
You're working on, like right now, a screenplay.
Well, you know, it's not something I really broadcast, but still full-time writing. I have writing journalism. I have a couple other things that I've written that are long form that are in various places. Got a really big magazine story for Los Angeles Magazine that's actually about growing up in LA and a lot of stuff that once you read it, you're probably going to want me back on the show. So I have to what? Save some stuff.
You can't divulge here?
It's too much the last few minutes.
Give me a little taste.
Some of the things I touched on in terms of identity and not quite fitting in and passing in different groups and the feeling so lost and feeling so not sure who you are that you're really seeking acceptance, maybe in the wrong places. Very ambiguous.
Yeah.
But... just a direction my life could have gone and did go for quite some time, and it'll be exciting.
Interesting. Yeah. Drugs?
Of course. I mean, that's a subhead of, you know.
And that's coming out in Los Angeles Magazine?
It's supposed to be coming out in November. Maybe it's December. But something I actually wrote for the New York Times Magazine and got killed, and we had to spend time. Rejections, man. I mean, it's you have to be able to roll with those quick and figure out how to make it work. You know, it's,
yeah.
I wish that's what I learned in school.
Where'd you go to school?
Because
you said you didn't go to college right after high school.
Right, I didn't get into any colleges.
You were a shitty student in high school?
I thought I was a good student. My mom didn't even come to my graduation. That's where I was at.
Why?
Why? I mean, I mean...
Were you a hellraiser? Were you a tough kid?
I guess I was. It seems so stupid and petty now, but I wasn't ready. I wasn't mature enough for this stuff. I had to just... Don't touch the stove. I had to touch a damn stove.
I was kind of that way, too.
God, what's... But I ended up going. I went to Santa Monica College, and then I went to Pitzer College, and then I went to. By the way, like Pitzer, they wouldn't even let me in. Now it was not like the admission scandal, but they said to me, if you get a 3.0 for a year, we'll let you in. And then I spent 5 years doing a lot of bad. I worked at a bank. I worked at a restaurant. I worked at temping, and I worked at like lots of. Humbling experiences that sucked, but anyway.
But good.
Character forming
some material.
Knowing
maybe.
What you don't want to do.
There you go.
Knowing what you don't want to do.
That's right.
But when I was 25, I got into Syracuse for their journalism program. No school. It was the only school who accepted me. So I was like, I'm going. It was a 1 year program, and I at least at that point, like I had already started to change and started to. Took out loans and all this stuff and to go. And I really wanted to move my life in a different direction. And I wasn't in a good place. I was willing to do anything, really to right the ship. And that experience was good for me in a lot of ways. I wish, as I said earlier, that it taught more about the more pragmatic approach to the business of creativity.
Yeah.
Because out of that class, supposedly the best journalism school in the country, me and one or two other people are working journalists. And I have like 200 or 300 kids.
That doesn't surprise me.
That's sad, man. I mean,
it
that's,
is, but it doesn't. I mean, based on the market conditions.
But that school is supposedly a powerhouse. Wow. I mean, this business, it really gets you. It's a
tough one.
It's a tough one. That's why I wanted to do a book. That's why I wanted to do bigger things, because it's also more exciting. It's I keep using the word exciting, and I never even use that word, but I mean that it's something different, and I think new experience is very important for a creative person, because if you're coming up against the opposition of challenging market, especially as a freelancer, you're going up against staff people, you better come with good ideas and good material and be easy to work with and be able to file that invoice on time and then keep them honest, but not push too hard so they keep taking your pitches. Wow. And these are the kind of tight ropes that they don't teach you.
Yeah, they need more practical instruction. I agree. Like I went to USC and got my MFA, and they sort of prided themselves on being more nuts and bolts, but you can never have too much of that. And I think there are certain elements of the business. I'm imagining it's the same in journalism, that there's some mysteriousness to it. So it can be hard to teach. How do you tell somebody how to navigate all this stuff and get an agent and find the right publisher and time it right? I mean, There are some practical things you can do, but right. Then some of it, the cards sort of have to fall your way.
Your product better be very good.
That's right.
Number one.
Yeah. Well, you got your book in print.
You like my product?
You got a good product here. It's a quality product.
It's also a pretty nice actual book. I mean, in terms of the cover, it's hardcover. It looks pretty.
Yeah.
These things are important. Let's not forget. I mean, we do all judge these books by their cover.
To some extent, yeah.
We judge by everything as much as we might say we don't. And there's good and bad to have a small publisher, and
you judging my podcast by its logo?
You, I'm enamored to be here on a Saturday morning.
Well, hey, it's great to meet you. Congratulations and best of luck on everything that you have going.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, that is Adam Popescu, and his debut novel is called Nima. It's available from Unnamed Press. You can find him on the internet at adampopescu.com. You can find him on Twitter. His handle there is @AdamPopescu. He's got an Instagram @AdamPopescu. He's got a Facebook. He's got it all. Check it out. The book, once again, is called Nima. Go get your copy. Thank you to Tiger in My Tank for the interstitial music there at the top, in between monologue and interview. Don't forget, if you want to tip your server, you can do that at patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you would like to write to me, the address is letters@otherppl.com. Let me know what you think. Tell me a story. Say hello. And don't forget about the Other People app. This program has its own official app. The Other People with Brad Listy app is free. It's available where you get your apps. It's 100% free. Everything's free. And just give it away. So, good talking with Adam Popesco. A little jealous of his global travels and adventure and tracking lions and whatnot. Sounds good. Also, forgot to tell you this at the top of the show. I don't even know if I don't think I can fit it in, but I'll try. I went to watch baseball at a sports bar the other night because it was the playoffs and I'm a Brewers fan and the Brewers were playing and they wound up losing, but it was like this sports bar in Silver Lake in LA, and apparently it was trivia night. Like every Tuesday it was trivia night, but there happened to be this playoff game. And it was like explicitly a sports bar with sports paraphernalia on the walls and like, a dozen flat screen TVs and all the, all the trappings of an American sports bar. But we went there to watch the game, like, because what better place, right? And then in the middle of the game, towards the end, when things were getting tense, this young lady gets on a microphone. See, this is too long of a fucking story. Who am I talking to on Wednesday? Oh, I have another poet. What's up with that? I have another poet on the show. Her name is Elizabeth Cantwell. Stay tuned. Wait, what? Yeah. Anyway.